This is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I'm your host, Eamon Ormseth. Today we're joined by Dr. Sam Brody.
Before we begin, a few news briefs. An Israeli attack in northern Gaza has killed three sons of Hamas chief Ismail Haniyeh as Israel continues its bombardment of the besieged enclave on the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr. In an interview with Al Jazeera Arabic, Haniyeh confirmed the killing of his children Hazim, Amir, and Muhammad, along with a number of his grandchildren on Wednesday. The killings come as the United States has been calling on Hamas to accept a temporary ceasefire. There has been no apparent work done yet on increasing aid to Gaza by opening an additional border crossing from Israel and accepting shipments at a nearby Israeli port, according to the New York Times. Facing international condemnation after an Israeli strike killed seven workers for an international aid group, Israel said last week that it would reopen the Erez crossing between Israel and northern Gaza for aid delivery. But satellite imagery taken on Tuesday showed that the road leading to Erez on the Gaza side was blocked by rubble from a destroyed building, a crater, and other damage that was also visible in images from last week and last month. Dr. Sam Brody is
the Associate Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Kansas. His research focuses on modern Jewish thought about politics and economics. His 2018 book, Martin Buber's Theopolitics, received the Jordan Snitzer Book Award from the Association of Jewish Studies. More recently, he has published essays on Jewish thought and political economy in Religions and the Jewish Quarterly Review. He has previously taught at the University of Chicago and the University of Cincinnati. Sam, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Sam, Understanding Israel-Palestine is currently doing a series on the Israel lobby. We've talked about AIPAC and the role that AIPAC plays in generating pro-Israel support amongst U.S. politicians. And more recently, we've been talking about the Anti-Defamation League, or the ADL, as it's frequently referred to in abbreviation. I'm wondering if you can help characterize the ADL and the role that it plays just more broadly as an organization before we get into the specifics of how the ADL is a component of the Israel lobby.
Sure. So that's the perfect question to start out with, because on the surface, the ADL would appear to be a U.S. domestic-based civil rights organization. There has increasingly been a perception, and I believe it was the author Noah Colwin writing in an article for Jewish Currents who coined this phrase, that the ADL should actually be considered an Israel lobby with a civil rights hobby. It is focused on policing the boundaries of discourse about civil rights in such a way as to exclude concern for Palestinian rights and criticisms that it considers excessive, and it arrogates to itself the ability and authority to determine what is excessive criticism of the state of Israel, and whatever exceeds those bounds as it decides them, it declares to be anti-Semitic. So in that sense, it operates to exclude Palestinian rights advocates from the mainstream of civil rights work as it determines it. And it sees this as a form of protecting Jews, although many Jews, and in particular the ones involved in the Drop the ADL campaign, would argue that you actually can't fight anti-Semitism without being in coalition with people who are fighting against other forms of discrimination. And I mean that in a practical way. I don't mean that you shouldn't. I mean that you can't.
I know that the ADL got its start, I believe, 1920s, 1930s, when a Jewish man was wrongfully convicted. It was clearly a case of anti-Semitism. Going into the 1930s, pushed back against the anti-Semitism of Henry Ford. And then, of course, in the run-up to World War II and the Nazi invasions of Western Europe and the persecution of Jewish and other people in the Holocaust, the ADL made its name. After World War II, when the State of Israel was founded, we saw a shift in foreign policy towards support for Zionism. Is it fair to say that that's also when the ADL began to take positions on Zionism and begin this sort of policing of civil rights work that you mentioned?
I think so. The case that you're thinking of was actually in 1913. It was the case of Leo Frank. He was the president of the B'nai B'rith of Atlanta, and he was accused of murdering a young girl and was actually kidnapped from prison and lynched. Most historians today consider him to be innocent, although there was an interesting incident, I believe, last year or 2 years ago, where someone had written a Broadway show about him, and the show was picketed by Nazis who claim to this day that he was actually guilty and that the entire mainstream way of remembering the case has been, biased by the perfidious Jewish agenda. So in that early period, and in the Henry Ford case that you mentioned, the ADL was largely focused on Nazi influence in the US. There was a significant partnership with organizations that were fighting the Klan and other racist hate groups. And so they did bank a certain amount of credibility as a civil rights organization. But what you start to see in the late 60s and 70s is actually parallel with what you see in a number of the other Jewish establishment organizations, you might say, which is that they come to agree on a definition of something that they call new anti-Semitism. And new anti-Semitism basically means delegitimization of Israel. Before, anti-Semitism had meant that you believe in a Jewish conspiracy to control the world and that Jews are the secret hidden power behind capitalism and communism and all world events and that they engineer everything for their own benefit. Now, anti-Semitism means you think that the Palestinians should have a state or you think that Israel was founded in a way that was illegitimate or there's a settler colonial project or any number of ways of framing claims to Palestinian rights that they consider illegitimate because they define them as essentially denying Jewish self-determination. And over the course of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, I would say it became largely perceived that that became their primary focus. So instead of fighting the kind of anti-Semitism that most people think of as anti-Semitism when they look at history, they fight Israel criticism, which they consider to be the new anti-Semitism.
The ADL has been implicated in surveilling both Arab American and Black American communities, particularly communities that were working for Palestinian rights and Palestinian liberation. And that there have been instances where the ADL has collaborated with the FBI. And even allegations, which I believe Margot got into in her last episode, of the, ADL's coordinating at least with the Israeli government. Certain occasions. As we've discussed in other episodes, at the same time as the ADL has positioned itself as an opponent of white supremacy, as an opponent of neo-Nazism in the United States, at a time when the election of Donald Trump and more open presence of, white Christian nationalism, we have sort of these two currents. We have increasing pro-Palestine sentiment in the United States, and we also have, more open support for white Christian nationalism, which has obviously an anti-Semitic component to it. How has the ADL positioned itself between these two countervailing forces?
Good question. So I would say, in order to frame the first part of what you just said, that the ADL is an establishment organization in more than one sense. So usually when people talk about it as an establishment organization, they mean that of the whole range of Jewish organizations out there, some are establishment in that they're older and they're better funded and they're considered more mainstream, and others are newer and more considered more fringe. But it's also an establishment organization in the sense that it firmly believes that it achieves its mission by aligning with the larger non-Jewish establishment. And so it attempts to achieve that by means such as the ones you described, by surveilling people that it considers extremists and giving that information to the FBI, by giving awards to police chiefs and engaging in trainings for police and so on, because it presents itself as in the center between equally dangerous left and right-wing extremes. And I think that what you saw during the Trump administration was that actually it considers what it calls the left-wing extreme more dangerous than the right-wing extreme. Even in a moment when the right-wing extreme engages in actual mass murder of Jews, like at the Tree of Life synagogue, they still seem to be more focused on what are pro-Palestinian students saying on college campuses than on what the Nazis are up to. And I think this can only really be explained by their concern that if Palestinian rights are broadly accepted as a progressive cause, including by Jews, that that will lead to a major PR setback for the state of Israel in the same way that it did for South Africa and in other similar instances. So what you see in many occasions, and the most recent one was where the ADL just honored Jared Kushner, and the CEO, Jonathan Greenblatt, was on the stage with Jared Kushner, who is supposed to be the the figure who makes it so that Trump can't be anti-Semitic, right? Like, oh, he has a Jewish son-in-law and Jewish grandchildren. Like, that's like saying he can't be sexist because he has a daughter. You know, it's the most ridiculous argument, but they will fully agree with this. And what happens is that basically they will give, they'll hand out passes to right-wing anti-Semites like Elon Musk. All they have to do is say, I'm pro-Israel, go to Israel, go to a Holocaust museum, and they get a pass. They seem to only hand out these passes after certain rituals are gone through, right? But they'll ultimately give you the pass and they'll say, oh, you're a friend of the Jewish people because you're a friend of Israel. And the element of analysis of like, what is anti-Semitism and how does it work and what's it doing in society and how does it fuel the thinking of white nationalism is untouched, right, by this procedure.
Pretty early on after October 7th, I believe the ADL sent out a letter in conjunction with, I think, the Brandeis Center that alleged that chapters of Students for Justice in Palestine were potentially providing material support for terrorism due to alleged support for Hamas. Would you say this is an example of repression of Palestine organizing of the sort that we've discussed?
I mean, I'll say a couple of things about that. So the main thing was that the national chapter, the national organization of SJP, put out a statement that was similar to many statements put out by left-wing groups that a lot of people on the Jewish left, me included, thought were really bad statements, right? Like they would say that basically Hamas is not responsible for its actions. Israel is responsible for Hamas's actions. So all the dead of October 7th can be blamed on Israel. And I think that's basically the same as what the Israelis are saying now, that like all the dead of Gaza can be blamed on Hamas. They're not responsible for their own actions, but rather Hamas is responsible for everything they do. But the thing is that the ADL is not actually a civil rights organization that's in coalition and conversation with these organizations. If you are, then you can tell them things like, we think that this statement is bad. They might even trust you to look at the statement before they issue it if you're actually in an ongoing working relationship, but they're not. They're outsiders to that coalition. And so all they do is they criticize from outside. And in particular, in this case, I think what you're seeing is they know that there's a free speech issue that they can't overcome. And the material support argument is being used to get around the free speech issue.
So despite positioning itself as a defender, even champion of civil rights, in this case, the ADL is using a form of lawfare to suppress the right to free speech.
I would say that's exactly correct, yes.
If you're just tuning in, I'm interviewing Dr. Sam Brody, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Kansas. We're discussing the history of the Anti-Defamation League, or the ADL, and the role it plays as a part of the Israel lobby.
The best way to fight anti-Semitism is in coalition with other groups fighting, you know, other forms of oppression. And you touched on how you disagreed with some of the language in the national SJP statement, but that in coalition work, there is room for that, you know, internal conversation and critique. Can you say a little bit more about how you envision the fight against anti-Semitism in coalition with some of these other
Yeah, I mean, the flip side of what I said is that the ADL will often tell Black activists they're getting their fight against racism wrong because they are trying to make connections to Palestinian rights, right? And so that's the sort of perfect example of how when you're in an actual coalition with another group, you have conversations behind the scenes and you talk and you have sometimes difficult conversations, right? And this is going to be true of any intersection, right? This is going to be true of women who think that a particular leftist organization they're in is sexist, or queer people who think that a particular Black organization they're in is homophobic, or any possible intersection you can imagine involves this type of work. But the ADL does not evince much evidence of actually seeing itself as engaging in some sort of power sharing where you have to actually talk to your partners. They want to dictate. They want to be police. And so they want to say, oh, well, we know that you mean to fight racism, but you're including anti-Israel stuff in your that in fighting racism. So you're doing it wrong. And I think what that leads to is many cases of people feeling like anytime you criticize Israel, you get called anti-Semitic. Anti-Semitism itself, therefore, is not a real thing. Like, there are a lot of people who think anytime anyone brings up anti-Semitism, they're only trying to shut down criticism of Israel. And that's an effect of doing it this way, right? So, like, there are many, many people, and I think you see this especially in England with all that, with the Corbyn situation. There are many people who think that's all it ever is. The only reason anyone would ever mention anti-Semitism in a left-wing context is to shut down criticism of Israel. And so that severely inhibits the fight to treat anti-Semitism as one among these other intersections, like of things that you have to fight, because it leads to people thinking that it's purely a tactic by the right to prevent people from achieving Palestinian rights. And it actually, what that does is it has a feedback loop effect where young Jewish people who are getting involved in progressive organizations like Black Lives Matter, for example, then feel that they actually have no place in those organizations and they have no choice but to move right and join Zionist organizations, which claim to be the only organizations that are looking out for them. Since the very, very beginning, like when Theodor Herzl in the 1890s, this was the founder of political Zionism, the founder of the World Zionist Organization, when he was a journalist in France and he was covering the Dreyfus Affair, right? And there were all these people who, this was a Jewish army officer who was accused of spying for Germany. It wasn't true. They found the real spy. But the point is that this dynamic where it's perceived that, oh, France is the liberal enlightenment country, but they've turned on the Jews. So therefore, Jews cannot seek salvation in alliances with others. They're on their own. And the only solution is Zionism. You see that dynamic over and over, and it's happening again today. So the ADL contributes to that through this sort of imperious attitude that it takes, where it gets to tell other people how to fight their things and how to fight its thing.
Because of the ADL's heavy-handed approach, it's actually undermining the fight against anti-Semitism because it has cheapened the charge of anti-Semitism by using it to advance pro-Israel policies in certain political contexts.
That's right. And then there's also the point that I made earlier becomes important here again, right? So Elon Musk can just have this complete pattern of doing anti-Semitic things, but as long as he, Dick says, toes the line on Israel and says the right thing about Israel, then there doesn't have to be any ongoing concern about him from their perspective. So it's almost the opposite. Like, right, if it's, it was very, very telling when Jonathan Greenblatt called him the Henry Ford of our time. I think that was actually an amazing moment. He was on TV getting interviewed, and he meant it as a positive. And then there was such a blowback that even he had to walk it back, right? But he was right. He is the Henry Ford of our time. He's a car manufacturer who runs an information network and uses it to spread anti-Semitism. But instead of fighting him constantly, he sort of says, okay, go to Israel and you're fine, right? So that makes it seem like anti-Semitism isn't real, like that all that they're all that they care about is criticism of Israel. And people who are actually engaged in the ongoing project of anti-Semitism, which is to take all the liberation movements that are happening anywhere and say that these are all subversive elements that are being secretly run by a small cabal of foreigners who are trying to subvert your good salt of the earth culture, right? They don't have to talk about that. They don't have to deal with it. And it just spreads and spreads and spreads, and they're not fighting it at all.
I wanted to discuss the ADL's position that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. As you said earlier, some call this the new anti-Semitism. How are we to make sense of this assertion by the ADL?
It is a product of the mid-20th century American Jewish mindset. You would not have found the major players in the Zionist movement making this claim first half of the 20th century because they were engaged in an ongoing debate constantly with all of the other different factions in the Jewish world, the Bundists and the other types of socialists and the liberal assimilationists and all of these people. And there was such a thriving and rich debate in the Jewish world that there was no question that, like, the people who weren't Zionists were anti-Semitic. It would have been an absurd thing to say. But after the creation of the state, and even more so after the Six-Day War, what you see in the US context is a much more solid block forming of support for Israel among American Jews. And again, and especially in the early 70s after the Yom Kippur War, when it appeared that, after the Six-Day War, there was this sense of invincibility. Like, the threat was followed by the sense of invincibility. But then in 1973, with the Yom Kippur War, they seemed vulnerable after all. You know, Egypt scored this surprise attack and Golda Meir resigned. So there was a sense that Israel is vulnerable after all. And there was this sort of mapping of the Holocaust onto the situation of Israel. It should be reminded, we should remember that at that time, the leaders of some of the Arab countries that Israel was at war with were saying genocidal things like, we're going to kill all the Israelis, we're going to wipe Israel off the face of the map, and so on. They weren't saying, we're going to decolonize and have Palestinians have equal rights. So there was this sense that the Arab countries are trying to perpetuate a second Holocaust on the people of Israel. And so anyone who would side or align with Palestinians in any way was seen as aligned with that project, with this genocidal project to destroy what was now basically half the Jewish population of the world. You know, if you go back to the beginning of World War II, there were 16 million Jews in the world. There are still fewer than that today, right? The Holocaust has not fully been recovered from. And the historic Jewish population centers, which were in Europe and the Middle East, by 1950, 52, were both empty of Jews in Europe because of the Holocaust, and in the Middle East because the founding of Israel led to Jewish populations of Arab countries being seen as traitors and fifth columns, and most of them left, right? Not all for Israel, but many for Israel. So that means that you now have this situation where the Jewish population centers, instead of being in their historic locations in Europe and the Middle East, were in the US and Israel. Obviously, Israel's in the Middle East, but I mean, spread throughout the Middle East. And so there was this sense that threats to Israel are therefore threats to 50% of all the Jews, and any alignment with Palestinians whatsoever was seen as basically genocidal in nature. So that's where you get this idea of the new anti-Semitism from. They actually don't believe that people want to achieve justice for Palestinians in a way that doesn't involve the mass killing of Jews. They don't believe that. That's where it comes from.
A way ADL has gathered statistics on anti-Semitic incidents, it includes mm-hmm. pro-Palestinian rallies. I think another That's example right. of how the ADL is cheapening the charge of anti-Semitism for its own political agenda.
Right. When you look at their audit of anti-Semitic incidents, it is a mixture of things that anyone would consider an anti-Semitic incident, like, you know, and also completely varying levels of seriousness in the lists. So you'll be reading the list and it'll be like, someone shot at two Jews leaving synagogue in Los Angeles. Someone beat up a Jewish man who was walking down the street in New York. And then like right underneath that, it'll be like a BDS poster was attached to a telephone pole in Berkeley. And you're just like, wait, hold on. It's another example of how they, it's ironic really, because they would say, they'll tell Black organizations that when they care about Palestinians, they're becoming distracted from what they should be focused on, which is anti-Black activity in the United States. But they clearly have become distracted. The political argument that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, as I said, the mood is rooted in this sense of believing that anyone who is anti-Zionist is genocidal. But they know very well, right, that it's still true that many ultra-Orthodox Jews, if not most ultra-Orthodox Jews, are not Zionist theologically or politically. They're currently engaged in mass protests to resist the draft in Israel, and that they sort of put them aside. Like, those are, we don't have to take those people seriously. They don't count. We only really are talking about the non-Jewish anti-Zionists anyway, is something that they'll, you know, sometimes seem to mean. And so again, that leads to this feedback loop where people who are in the pro-Palestine coalition actually don't want to talk about anti-Semitism at all, because it's basically been used to shut them down so often that I often think that when people, you see people at marches with signs that say anti-Zionism does not equal anti-Semitism. And it's like, that's true, but it doesn't actually mean that you might never be anti-Semitic in some way, right? Like, but nobody wants to have the conversation because of the way that they've cheapened the discussion and turned the whole thing into just this blunt instrument.
Sam, for people that are newer to this issue, they see terms like Zionism and anti-Zionism thrown around quite frequently. However, not so often are these terms carefully defined. Can you define Zionism and then secondarily define what opposition to Zionism would mean?
Yeah, thank you. This is a really important question. And my tendency as a historian would be to talk about all the things that Zionism has historically meant, which is not necessarily that helpful. It's really good in a class But today, people tend to use the term Zionism simply to mean support for the state of Israel. Historically, Zionism was a movement to, it was seen as a Jewish nationalist movement. It was not the only Jewish nationalist movement. There were a lot of people who agreed, who thought that in the various places that they lived, for example, the Russian Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, that there should be spaces for Jewish autonomy to govern themselves, send kids to their schools where the language would be their Jewish language, teach Jewish stuff in the schools. And the Zionist movement was distinguished primarily by its focus on the fact that there should be that Jewish autonomy, but it should be in Palestine. And then specifically over time, and especially in the 1930s and 40s, the autonomy came to be defined specifically as a state and as a state with a Jewish majority. So previously, there had been many strands within the Zionist movement that did not think that Zionism meant establishing a state or establishing a state that would be defined by its Jewish majority. But that eventually came to be what Zionism meant. And so today, I think that people who are anti-Zionist, broadly speaking, define themselves as opposed to the idea that there should be a state with a Jewish majority. And the reason I am saying it that way is that to defend a particular ethnic majority in a state, you have to have policies that will make sure that the majority is perpetuated. And those policies are almost always, and they're inevitably going to be illiberal in some way, because otherwise you can't control whether some other population ends up with 50% plus one of the population, right? So as opposed to the United States, technically, which is defined as a civic democratic republic, the majority, certainly white politics in the United States are driven by fear of becoming a minority, right? But it's not actually in the definition of the United States that it has to be a majority white state. That's part of the motivation of white nationalism today, is to like make that be a driving force of politics. So an anti-Zionist is really just anyone who doesn't think that there needs to be a state with a Jewish majority. And that could include many people who believe in strong historical Jewish connection to the land of Israel, and who believe that Jews should be able to live safely and peacefully in Israel, but who don't believe that they have the right in doing so to establish the sort of set of political tools that you would need to maintain a state with a Jewish majority, which requires essentially the dispossession and expulsion of the other population of that place. But most of the people who consider themselves liberal Zionists believe that in order to have a Jewish majority and to also have democracy, then you have to restrict the borders. Whereas the right wing says, whatever, we can control the whole land and it doesn't matter, we'll do what we have to do. So people being against that is just, it's a political position. It has nothing to do with the traditional form of hatred known as anti-Semitism. And I don't think that it also deserves to be classified as a new anti-Semitism. But it's certainly possible for people to articulate critiques of Israel that do fall into that old category. You just have to listen to David Duke or Kanye West. And the way that they talk about Israel is the same way that they talk about all Jews everywhere. And so those are clear instances where there's overlap. But simply saying that on a political level, you don't think that Jewish self-determination requires or necessitates the domination and expulsion of Palestinians, there's no connection between that and anti-Semitism whatsoever.
Dr. Sam Brody, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Kansas and author of the book Martin Buber's Theopolitics, thank you for joining Understanding Israel-Palestine today.
Thank you so much for having me.